Accession number 27229, Reel 5.
Bob Jones, Reel 5. So, you were working up in Malta. What happened from there?
Well, we then set off to catch up in the with our the fleet in the Pacific. So we sailed through to Suez Canal, where we had an interesting little happening, especially to me, because I don't know if you know, but in the middle of the Suez Canal there's some big lakes, shallow lakes, and of course you have to go very, very slow through the canal. But we got into the lakes, and I was a bit surprised. The ship suddenly went up to full speed before we finally anchored for the night. And what turned out was that the captain had told the midshipmen that when the ship goes fast in fairly shallow water, the stern tends to sink. It's just it's like going fast in the canal. You get sucked into the side. There's a little bit of pressure, and you get a stern wave coming up. So he'd gone up to full speed, knowing it was safe to do it, and sent the midshipman down to the stern, to the quarterdeck, to see the wave. And unfortunately, the wave was so high that it had flooded his cabin, because they'd left the scuttle open. And I had learned this, about this, on my initial course about ship construction and stability and this, what they call the Bernoulli effect of shallow water or narrow waterways, where you must go very, very slowly, otherwise you ground. And so he thought it was a good demonstration, you see. And he ended up with about 2 inches of water in his cabin. It was the Admiral's cabin, really. We had got an Admiral, so he was living in it. So that was a bit of fun. And then we went off across through the Red Sea, which was so bloody hot. I thought I didn't think I would survive anymore, but we never ever encountered anything as hot as the Red Sea. Of course, we were going down the Red Sea in June, July, more July, I think, with the wind behind us, so no air. And it was unbelievable. But once you got out in the Indian Ocean, that was okay. And then we sailed across to Colombo, where I had my next exciting experience. We only stayed there to refuel. And the morning we were due to sail, comes the news that an atomic bomb has been dropped in Japan. And as I think I told you earlier, I actually knew about this. And going back in history, I had done the work I'd done on uranium, knowing what it was all about, and then left it. And of course, it was secret, so I didn't know any more about what was happening, but except that I knew that some of my friends were still at it and they'd gone to the States. And I think it was sometime while we were in Malta, I thought, there were one or two articles in the papers about a secret weapon or something. I wonder if things worked. So I wrote home to my wife and I said, post me my final year university notes, because I had a lecture on it. Because when it was first discovered, it was public knowledge, the nuclear fission. So she posted these things, and would you believe it, they were in the post in Colombo the day the bomb dropped. So I had my old notes. And so I remember the gunnery officer saying, well, I've got a bit of TNT, you know. And I said, well, it bloody well isn't. So I went to the captain and I said, I know how all this works, so would you like me to give a talk? So he said, yes, please. So we sailed that night and I put a blackboard up in the wardroom and I gave a lecture on nuclear fission. And the principles of the atomic bomb, and I should think it was probably the first lecture that was given in the world almost. It was the same night, and I was just lucky I got those notes. I think I could probably have done it without them, really. And so that was exciting, and we were on our way to Australia then, to Fremantle. Well, before we got, it took several days, of course. And so during that voyage, we had the second bomb, and then we had the Japanese surrender just before we arrived in Fremantle. And I'd given the lecture two more times to the ship's company in the what used to be the old hangar, which was a big kind of cinema now, and so I had a packed house for this lecture twice over. And then we, of course, arrived in Fremantle on VJ Day. And we had one day ashore before we sailed, so a lot of us went into Perth, which is just up the river. And I've said before, I've no idea what Perth's like on a normal day, because everybody was balmy, they were all drunk. There were people going around with cars with tin cans hanging, people climbing the buildings, waving cans of beer and everything. I can't know, it was a shambles, really. But obviously, everybody was over the moon. So from that point on, I had a feeling that I was probably going to come home again. I think we all thought, well, couldn't we just turn around and go back? They don't need us. Well, they said, no, chum, you're the last one out. You're going to be the last one back. So we went on to Sydney, where we had a few days picking up supplies and all sorts of things and tiddling the ship up ready for the Admiral, and then up to Formosa, where I recorded how the Admiral came on board and I had my first encounter. And what is more, from the moment the Admiral arrived on board, I became the squadron Met officer, as distinct from the ship's Met officer. So I received another 2 and 6 a day pay. And I reckon I earned the first half crown a few times over. So from there, we cruised up and down, and we were then under orders of the American 7th Fleet. And we had to do what they said, and it was decided that we would go into Shanghai. We would accompany the 7th Fleet headquarters ship, the Americans, into Shanghai. So we had to cruise up and down for a few days till we finally had the order to move. So the Americans led the way. And with their headquarters ship, with their admiral, and of course they moored themselves right in the number one position, right opposite the Bund, and we were shunted up several hundred yards up to the side, turning up a bit further up the river. You see, because the Brits, you know, can't have them showing off, you know. So we tied up there, and we were then spent a long time, as it were, liberating Shanghai, liberating the British internees who'd been locked up for years. And they weren't treated as prisoners of war. They were not extremely badly treated there. But they'd been interned, and they all had homes to go to, most of them. Of course, they lived there. And so we had a lot to do with that. But we had a lot of spare time, and we were going ashore in this incredible place. And it was rather interesting. We were there for 3 months at the end of till the end of the year, from about September till Christmas. Well, we left in the new year. And when you went up the famous Nanking Road from the waterfront, the main avenue of Shanghai, you didn't go far, and there's a great banner which said, "Welcome to the American 7th Fleet." And then another great big banner across the road, "Welcome to Admiral Thomas C. Kincaid," who was the American fleet commander. And he went a bit more to "Welcome to the American something else." But he had to go about a mile down the road before he got a kind of faded sort of arch which said, "Welcome to the British cruiser squadron." Of kind of afterthought thing, you see. Anyway, that's how it was. When we left in January, there were banners around saying, "Yanks go home." It rings a bell, doesn't it, really?
What were the conditions like in Shanghai?
Well, they seemed... I don't know what they were like before, you see. And it seemed this was a Chinese city to me, and the Chinese seemed all very unconcerned and just padding around in their thousands and as if nothing had happened, quite honestly. It was never damaged, not where we saw. But they two things I stick out in my memory. One was that they had trams, you see, and it hadn't been there too long when the Americans decided that, and they drove on the left. The Americans decided that they should drive on the right. So they all switched over to driving on the right, not that there were much in the way of cars anyway, mostly rickshaws. But unfortunately, trams can't switch over because tram points are arranged so that you've got to go on the left, otherwise you can't go the other way. So we had an incredible chaos while the trams were driving on the left and all the rest of the traffic was on the right, so that was a little bit chaotic. And the other experience I had was a pretty personal one. In the first few days, I wanted to go and buy some things to send home to my wife, silk and things like this, so there's sort of stacks of it. And some of the officers who'd been out there before said, you've got to go down the Nanking Road to Yates Road, it's called, I think. It's about a mile down. That's where all the best silk shops are. So I went off down there turned into this Yates Road, and it was... And I think the Chinese did all the stock away during the war and got it all out again. Anyway, I went into this shop and I saw a rather nice silk dressing gown. And they were quoting things in dollars then. And I'd been told you ought to bargain a bit. Not that I have the temperament for bargaining, but never mind. So I said to the Chinese behind the counter, I said, how much is that dressing gown? $12, he said. I said, oh, well, let me have a look. And I said, there's a bit of a mark here on this lapel. And I said, I'll give you $10. Anyway, I got it for $11. While he was wrapping it up, the shop was full, mostly of American servicemen. And there was an American next to me, standing next to me, and he came in and he said, how much their dollars, their dressing gowns? So the Chinese said, $12. Gee, I says, is that all? I'll give you 15. So he gave him 15. Well, there were 30 the next week, and I've forgotten what they were when they finally left Shanghai, but God knows, I mean, I would not have believed it if I hadn't been there and seen it happen. They were chucking the money around like nothing. And the inflation took off absolutely incredibly. They decided to replace the old Chinese dollars that were operating with new ones, with the old ones had become 3,000 to the pound and the new ones were 80 to the pound. And of course all Chinese currency looks the same, really. It's got Chinese characters on with mandarins with whiskers, and you have to be very careful because they were using both lots of notes. And you've got to be careful you didn't pay the rickshaw bloke in the wrong sort of dollars, you see. And some of the ladies of Shanghai got wise to this and were taking the Americans to a nightclub and giving the Americans a 100 old note with their signature on it as a keepsake. And the Americans would give them a $100 note of the other one. Strange. But it was all a bit crazy, but an experience, and when you see it on the TV now, you're just incredible. But I've been back to China once since. It was 25 years ago. I went on an official delegation from the Department of Education, just at the time that the Mao Zedong and his gang had just collapsed. And they were trying to liberate it a bit. And they'd asked for a delegation from our education to help them to modernize their university science and engineering laboratories. And there was a small delegation of seven of us, and I was representing the Department of Education. And we toured China for a fortnight, going into about six universities. And we went to, flew into Hong Kong and then went right through to Peking, but we didn't get to Shanghai. I'd love to have gone to Shanghai again. But when you see Peking today, or Beijing, compared to what I saw only 20 odd years ago, 1979, it just doesn't be, you can hardly believe it, what they've rushed up in. It's almost like gone around with a big watering can, you know.
Where did you go through from Shanghai? Where was the next destination?
We went to Sydney. We were in Shanghai from September to almost Christmas, and said we're going to Hong Kong for Christmas. By this time, it had decided to withdraw practically the whole of the British Pacific Fleet back to UK. But there were still a couple of battleships, and a carrier and things. And the commander-in-chief, I'm told, had said, I would like to see my fleet before I go home. So we were all ordered to Hong Kong Harbour for Christmas, where there was a couple of battleships. And the commander-in-chief would look around and say, this is my fleet that I hadn't seen before. So we were there over Christmas, which was really quite fun, quite nice. And one memorable little event there, which was in the newspaper, I think on Boxing Day. The police had raided a brothel, and they'd found, I think it was about 20 cubicles in use, 19 occupied by American sailors, and one by one British sailor. And at that time, we had the whole British Pacific Fleet in harbour, and one American sloop, which we thought was quite a bit of... showed something anyway, whatever it was, I'm not sure. That was something to remember. Back to Shanghai for a couple of weeks, and then we said, we're now going to Sydney for a bit of rest and rehabilitation, and the ship needs a bit of refitting.
Is this where you made the recordings en route to Sydney?
Well, pretty well, yes. Yes, because we were told that we would go to Sydney and then that we'd be able to show the flag a bit.
Can you explain what they are, what you did?
What we did?
With the recordings.
Well, the captain said when we left, we were ready to leave Shanghai, he said, now we're going to Sydney, it's a 17-day voyage. The war's over, and we're going to enjoy ourselves. So we're going to have a big program of recreation and amusements and all sorts of things. And he set up a committee, of which I was a member. The gunnery officer, I think, was the chairman. And we set up what we called Operation Insomnia to keep everybody on the go for the whole 17 days. And I must say, well, at the time we got to Sydney, I was absolutely flat out because I'd sort of organised or taken part in about three quarters of these things. And I could just tell you one little event, which I suppose is typical of the Navy, I suppose. Our padre, very nice bloke, he and I were quite friendly. And he'd been in the ships as long as me, and he had a kind of nice sort of Jesus Christ sort of stained glass window beard, you know. Anyway, it turned out that he'd gone to the we were taking four or five Australian Air Force officers back home as passengers. So we were about 2 days out at sea, and I went into my breakfast in the wardroom and sat at the top of the table, as it happened. I was having my breakfast, and the other end of the table was the first lieutenant. He was an eccentric sort of chap, a nice bloke, but a bit eccentric. And in came one of the other officers with an Air Force officer, and I saw him introduce this Air Force officer to the first lieutenant, who proceeded to roar with laughter, get up and slap the other bloke on the back. And I thought, well, I know you're a bit eccentric, but it's a funny thing to do when you're introduced to somebody. What had happened was that the padre had gone to the captain before we sailed. He says, can I have permission to shave off my beard? So the captain said, yes, of course, but let's have a bit of fun. So what he persuaded him to do was, about 2 days out, he borrowed this Australian Air Force officer's uniform and was brought into the wardroom and introduced as Squadron Leader Parsons, who's been confined to his cabin since we left Shanghai, which people were surprised at. And do you know, the first lieutenant is the only man who recognised him. Nobody else recognised him. And we'd been shipmates for a year. I took his beard off. You just hardly believe it. And he spent the rest of the day going talking to the sailors, many of whom he knew, of course, and they didn't know him. And the flag lieutenant had been responsible for billeting the passengers in cabins, and the commander sent for him and tore a strip off him for not telling him where this bloke was on board. Meanwhile, the captain was going around trying to hide his grin. Well, I thought it was nice, a nice thing in the Navy. You know. I thought it was great. Anyway, I used to issue a forecast every day. We had a little ship's newspaper for the voyage, the Belfast Bugle, and I would put in the forecast until I got into a hell of a mess and stopped doing it. We got several days down. And we were having deck games every afternoon on the quarterdeck, deck hockey and all sorts of outdoor things. And I said it was going to be a nice afternoon. God, thunder and lightning and a lot came down. So I thought, oh, bloody hell. So I got out my climatic things. And, of course, there is a thing called the intertropical front between the north and south hemispheres where they collide. It's called the doldrums sometimes. And it waves up and down with the seasons. And this thing was, I thought, this is further north than it should be. It must have come quite a bit north. So I suspect that it's probably going to wave, that we're probably through it. So I said, the next day we're going to be nice, so on. So they got all the deck hockey out. Down the thunder and lightning, the whole bloody lot came down again. So I thought, it's moving back with the ship, because it do wave. So it'll probably be like this tomorrow. So I said, it's going to be thunder and lightning tomorrow. And they cancelled all the deck sports, and the sun came out. It was a bloody lovely afternoon. And so after that, I sent no more forecasts to the thing. I had to live with that. But it was the best I could do. There were no reports from anywhere that I could fasten on to. You're just on your own in this waste of the Pacific. So, and then we had three performances of our radio show, Radio Belfast. And the last one, Approaching Australia, had as its main sketch our story of how Australia was discovered by the captain's cook and so on. And that was great fun. And then we got to Australia and we all had some leave. The ship had some refitting and we really relaxed and it was very nice. I went up to the Blue Mountains for a break and another little silly event there. Because the padre was always, I was schoolie. We called the padre the bishop. And he and I decided to go and have a few days in the guest house in the new. And so I said, I'll go make the booking at the officers' club. So I made this reservation of two rooms. And I said, is it two of you? I said, yes, it's me and the bishop. So when we got into this place, and signed on at the desk, there was a chap in a cassock wandering around looking very ecclesiastical, and the bish went and got his room, and I was left by the desk, and the girl behind the desk said, which of you is the bishop? I said, oh, he's not a bishop really, he's just the padre. Said, oh, I see, we just called him the bishop. And this chap in the cassock never appeared in the cassock again. He appeared in shorts after that, but he obviously thought that we'd come with the bishop. Anyway, that was a bit of fun. And then we said we're going to show the flag, so we're going to New Zealand. And we had this invitation to put on a broadcast in Dunedin. and from Port Chalmers, which is the port for Dunedin. And so we decided to put on a Radio Belfast show with the script amended to the discovery of New Zealand by the captain's cook, which we did, and that's got recorded. And as I say, I'm going to give you, I think, one of the recordings of the original. It doesn't sound so good nowadays after all that time, but it was fun at the time. And from, we went to three places in New Zealand, Dunedin, then we went to quickly to Wellington just for a day, and then to Napier for several days in the North Island. I had a bit of an adventure.
Is Napier the Art Deco city?
Pardon?
The Art Deco city, was it Napier?
I don't know.
Was destroyed by an earthquake?
It was struck by an earthquake in the 30s.
Rebuilt in the 1930s.
It was rebuilt. It had been rebuilt. Yes, that's right. It's very rough ground there. And while we were there, an invitation came to the ship for three officers from a local army colonel who would like to take them out for the day to Lake Taupo, which is the middle of the island. So I was one of the three. The surgeon, lieutenant commander, chief, the doctor, and the torpedo officer. So this old boy turned up, and he was an old boy. Well, he'd be a lot younger than I am now, but anyway, this army saloon car. So we got in this car, we set off, and he drove pretty like a bat out of hell, really. Out of the suburbs and out into the countryside, and then it's about 100 miles to Lake Taupo. And after about 30 miles, we came to a bloody great signboat which said, "The next 50 miles are dangerous. It's through the mountains." Well, did he slow down? Bloody hell, no. We went over, went down hairpins on two wheels, and honestly, I thought it was the end of the world. We got down off the mountains the other end, and he went. Tried to take one corner too fast and couldn't. He went up the bank and the car turned over, fortunately, slowly at the final. So of course all we were covered in bananas and beer bottles and things from the picnic, and we got out, and she said, I will walk on ahead and see if I can get some assistance. So we managed to rocket back onto the wheels again. The doc got in, and I'll see if it's drivable. So he drove, and he said, "Well, it's drivable. The steering's a bit wonky. It would go like that, and you turn the wheel. It reacted rather late, and then it would do that." And after we'd done a couple of miles, a car came up, and the old colonel was in it. He hitched a lift. "Oh," he said, fine. He said, "Oh, well, we can get to Taupo now and get it mended there." So the doc said, "I think you might be a bit shaken, sir. I mean, perhaps you'd like me to drive." No, it's fine. "Well, perfectly all right," he said. He got in the thing. Well, he said, "The steering's a bit wonky, sir." He said, "I'm all right," he said. And we went off like this, zigzagging around. And all I could think of, that it was 100 miles back to the ship over the same bloody mountains. It got the thing mended. We went to see all the geezers and all the rest, all the sites. And thank God he drove back soberly. But when I saw the lights of the ship that night, I sort of did a big prayer. I thought, "I'm not going to see my daughter ever." But that was memorable. Then we went on to Fiji, which was, we were there for a few days, where we had a big welcome, and that was very, very nice. And then off to Japan, where it was a long trip again across the Pacific, where I had one of my triumphs,